there's going to be a tendency for them to try to solve all problems with more intensity. That's not going to be a good solution. So you're going to want, if I'm coaching them, I'm going to really work on, you know, helping them to be patient and to make sure that the low intensity sessions are exactly that, that we've got the heart rate on, that we're actually learning how to calibrate these sessions and getting comfortable going longer at these low intensity sessions. And then we're going to make sure that our high intensity sessions are in that correct zone where they don't go over the top. They don't go into the very highest intensity, but they keep it around the 90% that we've talked about.
The Triathlon Show 177. Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Dr. Steven Seiler. Steven is a sports scientist, a researcher, and a consultant with various high-performance sports entities. He is American, but lives in Norway and has done so for many, many years. I believe close to 25 years or so. And he is most famous probably for his research in the realm of polarized training. You could almost say that he's the godfather of it. And at least his research has definitely paved the way for it to become more well-known in the mainstream endurance sports media. So it's a great honor to have Steven on, and we can just scratch the surface really in this episode, because we could have talked for hours really. I didn't even get to half the questions and topics I wanted to talk about, but it's important to really get clear with the basics and the most important stuff and not get too hung up on the smaller details that really aren't of as much importance or really very insignificant importance compared to the big basics, the big rocks when it comes to training. So I think that we managed to cover all the most important things in this episode, which I'm very happy about. Before we get into the interview, big thanks, of course, to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Precision Hydration makes electrolytes that help you get hydrated and stay hydrated. And that is, of course, important for you if you're going to be losing a lot of sweat, which you are usually when you are doing endurance sports, but especially in long races. And even more so when the races are done in hot conditions, when you will be losing even more sweat and therefore more electrolytes and more sodium in particular. If you want to maintain performance, then you need to make sure that you have your electrolyte balance in check. So that's what Precision Hydration can help you with. And the best way to get started is to take their free online sweat test on precisionhydration.com. And that will give you an individual hydration strategy for your racing and training. And you can try your first box of Precision Hydration for free with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. And big thanks to Roka that you can find on roka.com. Roka are the world leaders in wetsuits, trisuits, apparel, and high-performance eyewear. And I just yesterday got an email from Roka at their newsletter that I'm subscribing to, and actually very exciting news in that email, because they have launched a line of glasses that are blue light blocking, which I'm sure you're aware the last couple of years or so these different blue light filter glasses have become more popular for good reason, because that can have a big impact on sleep duration and quality. If you're spending time in front of screens before bedtime and melatonin levels are affected. So Roka has launched a line of blue light blocking glasses, and they look really, really good. They don't look anything like the goofy ones that you can buy off of Amazon. They actually look like really glasses that you could wear anywhere. So I like that. They're not actually colored. They're just looking like regular glasses. So that's really cool news from Roka again on the eyewear side of things, which they are really pushing a lot. And so definitely check that out if you haven't already, both the sunglasses for various endurance and action adventure sports, but also, of course, their wetsuits, which is where it all started, with building the world's fastest wetsuit and then branching out into tri-suits, swimskins, buoyancy shorts, etc., all designed to make you faster. So check them out on roka.com and use the promo code TTS, all caps, to take 20% off your entire order. All right, we're almost ready to dive into the interview, but just a few definitions here before, so that you can stay with us if you're not quite as familiar with the, I guess, the physiological terms that we're going to be using and different lingo, polarized training lingo that's going on here, or physiology lingo, I should say, not polarized training lingo. But we talk about free zone and five zone models for training here, and these are just different ways to skin a cat of training in different intensity zones. In polarized training, especially in the research, it has commonly been done in a free zone model. So that means one low intensity zone, one mid zone or the threshold zone, which is sort of like in between. So between your first lactate threshold or your lactate turn point and the second lactate threshold, which is what we most commonly think of as the threshold, or most athletes think of it as the threshold anyway. And you can use FTP as a proxy for that second threshold. So the second zone in the free zone model lies in between these two thresholds. So between low intensity and high intensity. So it's moderate intensity, put simply, or threshold is the term that is used again in the scientific lingo for this intensity zone. And then the third zone in that model lies above your lactate threshold, the second lactate threshold, or second ventilatory threshold if you measure it that way. So essentially you could have the LT1, lactate threshold 1, or VT1, ventilatory threshold 1. They demarcate the zone 1 and zone 2 in that model, and LT2 or VT2, they demarcate zone 2 from zone 3 in that model. And that second threshold, that's again what we commonly refer to as threshold or FTP. So that's I guess the basic knowledge that you need to keep up with the discussion here. The five zone model, I should say, lies on top of those three zones, or you can sort of I guess interpolate. So zone 1, the recovery zone, would be like the low zone 1 in the free zone model, and zone 2 in a 5 zone model, that would still be low intensity. So that would, the top of zone 2 in a 5 zone model would be basically the top of zone 1 in a free zone model. And the zone 3 in a 5 zone model would be zone 2 in the free zone model. And zone 4 and zone 5, they would be the lower part and the higher part of zone 3 in the free zone model. Well, this is more or less how it goes. There are some nuances to this, but for all intents and purposes, we can use these definitions to dive into discussion. All right, so with the definitions clear and out of the way, let's dive into the interview with Dr. Steven Seiler. Today's guest on That Triathlon Show is Steven Seiler. Hi, Steven. Welcome to That Triathlon Show.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure, and you're probably perhaps the most requested guest that I get emails and social media messages about, that, hey, you should bring Steven Seiler on the podcast to talk about polarized training. And obviously you have been doing a lot of other great research as well, but since we have a limited amount of time, we'll focus this discussion on polarized training. So I think that the most listeners are familiar with who you are, and you've introduced yourself on plenty of other podcasts that we'll link to as well. So let's just jump into the main topic. And can you give us an overview of what polarized training is?
What it comes down to is that we know that if you want to be really good in endurance, you have to train a lot. That is the fundamental universal characteristic we see across the disciplines, is that there's a high volume of training. We've basically never seen a gold medalist that was able to do it on 3 days a week, to put it that way. So then the question becomes, okay, you need a high volume of training. We also know that we need some intensity. And the question then becomes, well, how do we balance that out in a sustainable way? And what we've seen from different sports disciplines is what tends to characterize, or what almost always characterizes, these gold medal winning athletes from rowing, from ski, cross-country skiing, cycling, and so forth, is they're actually doing a large percentage of that total volume of training at what is for them a fairly low intensity. That is below their first lactate turn point, we might say, to put a physiological term on it. So they're collecting a lot of hours at comfortable, you know, reasonably comfortable intensity for them. And we've put some numbers on that. We've put numbers on it both in terms of percentage of training sessions, and said it's somewhere around 80% of their training sessions tend to be at this lower intensity. And we've said that if you measure it as time in zone based on heart rate, it may actually look more like 90% of their total time is at this low intensity.
What is your preferred way of quantifying it? Do you think that any one of those methods is better than the other, or should you use both in combination?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think physiologically, I think it probably is more useful to think in terms of sessions, to think in terms, because it is the training session or that day that you make stressful. The entire period of time is going to be changed by that big hormonal response, that big stress response that you induce if you work at really high intensity. So I think in terms of understanding the nature of polarized training and what we're trying to achieve, it's probably better to think in terms of sessions, that, you know, certain days I'm trying to avoid triggering a big stress response. I'm trying to stay under the stress radar, you might say, and just collect minutes with good metabolic flux and good signaling for adaptation, but not a big stress response. And then other days, I'm going to turn that on. And that's what we see, you know, with these elite athletes, is they have tremendous intensity discipline. So sometimes it's appropriate to use heart rate to kind of see how things are looking. And sometimes I think it's appropriate to just put the training sessions in categories, or in a way in boxes, you know, the low intensity box, the middle intensity box, and the high intensity box. And then add it up over time and see, you know, am I getting this distribution right?
Yeah, that makes sense. And as you said, you have researched this in a lot of elite athletes across different disciplines. Can you discuss this, the evidence base, a bit more, like how much research has been done, and also how do these findings scale down from the elites to the amateurs and more less well-trained athletes?
Right. Yeah, so back when I first started looking at this, I was kind of struck by some observations I was making here in Norway, and then I came across I was asked to be a reviewer of a study of elite African or Kenyan distance runners, and they were training, they were marathoners, and what emerged when I looked at the data, it wasn't the focus of the authors, but when I looked at their data, I said, wow, you know, about 80% of their kilometers are actually below marathon pace. And then about, if I recall, it was more like 18% or so was faster than marathon pace. And a really small percentage was actually at marathon pace, which was their race distance. And so this really was interesting to me, because at the same time I was hearing from national team coaches in Norway that they're coaching the best cross-country skiers in the world with huge VO2 max values. And they were saying, working at the threshold is too much pain for too little gain. And so I said, well, that really surprised me, because I was kind of trained to believe that threshold training was the most efficient way to do things. And that wasn't what I was hearing and seeing. And so then we started collecting data to actually quantify what was happening in cross-country skiers. We started with juniors, and then we had good case data from Olympic gold medalists that we quantified with the help of the Olympic Federation here and a man named Espen Tunnesen, who I worked with. And so we started really digging into this across a number of different disciplines. And then ultimately, we started seeing this very consistent pattern, this polarization. Now, I have to say that, you know, in the early studies we did with the skiers and with rowers, it was very clear. It was a very clear polarization, meaning that there was a lot of training at low intensity, and then there was quite a bit of training at above the lactate threshold and very little at the threshold, very little in that zone two range of a three-zone model. So it was a clear, like a Nike swoosh, if you know what I'm saying, in terms of if you were to draw a curve, there was a clear nadir in the zone two area where there just wasn't much of that happening. And so that's why I coined the term polarized training model. Now, since then, there are other groups where that clear distinction between, you know, the amount in zone two and the amount in zone three has been it hasn't been as clear. But what's always there is a big volume of zone one training. And then exactly how the athletes solve the zone two, zone three distribution, it varies a little bit depending on their competition distance, some technical issues with their sport and so forth. So just so we have that in mind, the term polarized has come to, you know, live a life of its own. But what is very clear and fundamental is that the best athletes in endurance spend a lot of their time at an intensity that's below the first lactate turn point. They spend a lot of time at a low intensity.
Yeah, and to give some context here for listeners that maybe are not familiar with your free zone model that you discuss here, in a five zone model that is quite common as well, that would mean that a lot of that time would be in zones one and two, and correct, that would be the 80% of sessions or 90% of heart rate,
right,
time in zone in terms of heart rate. Can you discuss a bit more that, because it's interesting what you mentioned there with how that distribution of intensity in zone two and three in your free zone model, how it differs and how you started to find some differences and not always completely polarized in some other different disciplines depending on events. Can you elaborate a bit on that, and in which sports and or events do you tend to see differences from that original polarized model that you found in the skiers?
Well, you know, if you take rowers, they compete over 6-7 minutes. So their competition is actually basically at VO2 max or above in terms of intensity. And they are really polarized in their training. They just don't do much threshold training. Cross-country skiers are also very careful in their training. They do a lot of low intensity, and then they will apply, you know, the zone three, or they use a five zone model. So in a five zone model, they tend to do a lot of zone four. Now, if you go to you guys, a triathlon, Olympic triathlon, or particularly Ironman, then I can see, and we see some evidence that distribution may be more what we might call pyramidal, where you've got it kind of steps down from, you know, 80% at low intensity, and then maybe 10 and 10 or 12 and 8%, you know, at zone two and zone three. So there's different ways of skinning this cat. And one thing that's important to say is that we've done some experimental work where we've had trained athletes come in and do different training sessions, either clearly in zone one, clearly in zone two, or clearly in zone three. And then we've measured their recovery using heart rate variability to try to see what, you know, how do they recover from a 1 hour zone one session, a 2 hour zone one session, a 30 minute active zone two session, you know, or 30 minutes of threshold work, or an interval session, you know, with the typical kind of VO2 max intervals. And when we did that, we actually could not distinguish the recovery between zone 2 and zone 3. That is to say that in both cases, when they did these harder sessions, they had a delayed recovery as measured with heart rate variability, whereas when it was just zone 1, they recovered very quickly. So we start to get into some questions regarding, you know, zone 2 and 3, how different are they really? Do we trigger a stress response with the zone 2 just as much as zone 3, or enough that if we're going to go ahead and do zone 2, we might as well work a little harder? So those are where some of these questions come in. We have to keep in mind that the signal for adaptation and the stress that we impose on our athlete or on the body is not just a function of intensity. It's also it's intensity times duration. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I guess one of the concepts there that relates to this is you've talked about how the signaling often seems to be related to when you do these more high intensity sessions is often related to the number of minutes that you accumulate. So you also have talked about how those really hard short intervals are not necessarily always the best, but I guess that's where the difference between disciplines like the rowers that do 6-minute races and the triathletes that do 1 hour to 8 hour races at the elite and the difference between the sprint and the Ironman comes into play. So perhaps you can talk a little bit about that and how you would view the different type of intense sessions that you might do based on what your goal event is.
Right. Well, we've done quite a bit of work. We've both, looked at how the athletes actually train, how they kind of self-organize over time, their own training process. And then we've done experimental studies, and both kind of go in the same direction. And that is that for the high intensity, the HIIT training sessions, we tend to see very good results and kind of a sustainable level of stress by being at the low end of zone 3, or in a 5-zone model, actually in what we call zone 4 instead of zone 5, or at the upper end. Meaning in practice, what that actually will mean is that our athletes tend to choose to collect more minutes at around 90% of heart rate max, 91, 2, and not go all the way up into that really, the danger zone where they may be at 95, 96% of heart rate max, blood lactate 10 plus. They tend to avoid doing that very often. And the adaptations seem to occur quite nicely by collecting 30, 40 minutes at 90%. And the recovery seems to happen a bit faster. It's easier for them to come back the next day. And that's important.
I think this is something that I've seen and heard when interviewing a lot of the greatest triathlon coaches around that in triathlon, whether it's long distance or short distance, that doesn't really matter. They do seem to favor working the zone 4 in a 5-zone model compared to zone 5. For example, your colleague over there in Norway, Adil Tveiten, was a guest here in a past episode, and they do a lot of work right around that second lactate threshold, the LT2, right. So right. Perhaps even a little bit lower than 90%, might be 88% of heart rate max or something like
right.
that.
So yeah, and an eight, you may start at 88 and end up at 92 in the course of a workout. We have to remember there's some drift that tends to happen. So so it's in that area, upper end of zone. We have to kind of agree to either talk 5-zone or 3-zone in this talk. But if we're going to stick with 3, then I would say that the athletes tend to spend time right around that transition from zone 2 to 3, just, and often just on the 3 side, not too far over. And then they collect minutes, And a really tough interval session for these guys may collect 60 minutes, but that would be a very tough session. It wouldn't be a typical one. One of our gold medalist rowers, a guy named Olaf Tufte, That was his bread and butter session, was 6 times 10 minutes at essentially 90%. He did that 27 times in the year leading up to a gold medal. So that was a kind of a, just a standard zone four session for him. And that's, you know, that's a lot of minutes to collect at that heart rate. I think more typically it would be around 30 to 40. And that's kind of what we've prescribed pretty often, is say 4 times 8 minutes or 5 times 8 minutes. It would be a typical example that I use a lot and that I prescribe for my own daughter, who's a runner.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely makes sense. If we talk a little bit about why this works, like you've alluded to a few things already, but if we wrap it up, like why is this model, and regardless of how we skew the higher intensity zones, but the fact that that large amount of low intensity training is always there in the elite athletes, what's the reason that this works better than having slightly less work at the low intensity and slightly more at the high intensity side of things?
Well, I think a number of things. One is that we tend to overestimate the importance of the high intensity training, and we tend to think that it causes, that there's just very distinct adaptations, but the research does not support that. There's a lot of overlapping in the adaptive spectrum, and if you do enough minutes of low intensity training, it will also improve your VO2 max. For example, we've seen that in top skiers. They, you know, as young athletes, they increased their volume and their VO2 max went up, and they didn't increase the amount of high intensity training. So there, that's one issue, is that we kind of tend to ascribe a bit too much specificity to these different intensities that's really not there, because it is always a function of intensity times duration. And there's different ways of generating that signal. Now, the other issue is that we do have good data that shows that when you get above the threshold, you start to induce some hormonal responses. You start to induce a stress response that you don't see at the lower intensities. And that stress response is costly to absorb and to recover from if it happens too often. So one of the best ways to overtrain an athlete is just to train them kind of middle hard regularly, you know, and have this monotone signal where they're getting pushed into their threshold every day. That's a great way to stimulate an overtraining response, you know, or an over, you know, and just make them stagnate at best and get overtrained at worst. That's been done with experimental studies on horses, on humans. So that's something we've learned, is that if you want to overtrain an athlete, just create a monotone stress that's kind of right around their threshold and do it every day, and you'll put them in a bind pretty fast. You can do the same thing to a horse. But if you want to keep them healthy, and if you want to keep their, maintain their ability to both mobilize a big, you know, high intensity response when they need to, but at the same time have that, you know, good metabolic control at low intensities, then you need to distribute the work. It seems like the way we've been talking about, with a lot of low intensity and then periodic bouts of high intensity.
And when you say that, talk about that overtraining and stagnation at best when you train at your threshold, you're talking about as soon as you're going over that first lactate turn point, you trigger that larger stress response. So it's actually something that is not necessarily super uncomfortable. So for many age group athletes, which I think we'll get into next, you probably see that that these athletes, accidentally train there almost all the time. Is that correct?
I think you're right. Yes. Unfortunately, that's the most common mistake that is happening, is that these, you know, athletes, amateur athletes that don't have a lot of time to train, they're going out and, you know, doing a 45 minute or a 1 hour a ride or a run, and they're pretty much right around threshold or even above you know, from the first minute. And it feels pretty good. You know, they can do it. But if, you know, they just kind of get stuck there. And I've even used the term the training intensity black hole. It has, we have a tendency to get sucked into that middle intensity because it doesn't feel too bad. You can do it. So that the easy sessions tend to get pushed a little harder than they should be. And then you're not quite recovered when you need to do a high intensity session. So the high intensity sessions are not quite as hard as they should be. And things fall towards the middle. And that is the classic mistake that amateurs make.
Should then, if we talk about amateurs that have more limited time to train, so some might be as low as 5 hours per week, especially perhaps single sport athletes like runners. For triathletes, 5 hours is quite low, but it's definitely a lot of age group triathletes train around that time. But perhaps a quite common amount of hours for age group triathletes train is around 8 hours per week or so, 8 to 9 hours. Right. So how does it change anything with the distribution of high, low intensity for amateur athletes, or is it the same, and why, is the answer that you'll give what it is?
Yeah, the studies that we've done suggest that this works. It does scale down, so the best practice of the elites scales down to the non-elites, and they can really benefit from learning that discipline and keeping low intensity sessions low, and then having the, being ready to and be able to mobilize when they need to do high quality sessions. So that we've seen experimentally that model works. It scales down to the 8 hour a week athlete, and probably also even the 5 hour a week athlete. But then the other thing is, you know, if you tell me, hey, I've got 6 hours a week and that's all I got, then I can also think a bit about saying, okay, how do you do 6 hours? Well, I do an hour a day. Okay, let's think about actually doubling up and on one of those days making it a 2 hour session. And then we'll take a day off. You can get your work done. But now I'm going to generate a better signal for adaptation by stretching that low intensity session that you normally use an hour on. I want it to be a 2 hour session. I want it to be 2.5, you know, so I want low intensity sessions to get longer. And if I have to give up, if I have to say, all right, you take a day free so that you achieve that on your 6 hour time budget, then that's what I'll do. I'll reassign that time to try to get better low intensity sessions as well as the good zone 3 sessions. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I think you talked about like you have intensive training, but then you have extensive training as well. And exactly. That's the extensive training when you try to stretch it out. And I have a personal example. I've been these last couple of months, I've been really focusing on my long rides and getting rid more of a lot of the intensity, but really trying to extend those long rides. So I do a lot of 4 or 5 hour rides, which is typical for Ironman athletes, and I'm focusing only on half Ironman, but I've seen great results with just doing over distance rides, like much longer than what would be typical for half Ironman athletes. So that's just a personal example, and I feel that it's working really well. I get a good response from those really long rides.
Yeah, well, that's good, and that's what we see. And so, whether it's running, you know, for my daughter's preparing for a half marathon, and you know, she's doing 2 hour long runs, and just that same with the exact same goal is just to build durability, to build metabolic, just to be comfortable. And then, as we start to peak, and maybe as you begin to peak for a performance, then you're going to combine the long and the hard, you know, and maybe do a couple of hours of riding before you put in the hour high intensity to try to really get comfortably uncomfortable with that reality of having to go hard when you're already tired.
Yeah, that's exactly the plan.
Yeah, and you know, that makes sense. So we have to think of stretching ourselves both in duration and in intensity with different kinds of workouts, and then bringing it together in the competition.
Yeah. So for in practice, then we talked a little bit about how to distribute the hours in the week and still maintaining that large volume of low intensity. But since we also know now that a lot of athletes will be training too hard in those low intensity workouts, I think one of the most important things with this episode is to establish how to make sure that the athletes don't go too hard when they're supposed to go easy. So what some important things that we need to discuss then is like how to set the training zones and how to then follow and execute the workouts according to those zones. So let's talk a little bit about that and perhaps start around testing and how to establish those zones.
Yeah, well, you know, I think obviously most people don't have access to these fancy laboratory testing. They probably don't even have access to blood lactate, but they have heart rate, they have speed, they have power, and they have perception. They have their own perceptual calibration of what something feels like. And so what we need to do is ultimately calibrate their perception better than maybe it tends to be with the tools that are available. Now, if I'm working with an athlete and I don't have a laboratory, but I've got the heart rate, I've got a reasonable place to get good power and speed measurements, then one thing I'm going to want to do is I want to know what their actual heart rate max is. You'd be surprised how many athletes don't really know. And they say, well, I guess it's 220 minus age. Wrong. That's a good way to mess things up, because 220 minus age or 207 minus 0.8 times age, whichever one you use, it works reasonably well at the population level. It's terribly unreliable at the individual level. So that's one of the first things we need to get across is the athlete needs to have a reasonable idea of what their actual heart rate max is. And it'll probably be different for cycling than running and swimming. All three will be different because they're movement specific. Typically, for example, running will give the highest heart rate max, and then we tend to call the others heart rate peak. So the cycling heart rate peak might be 5-7 beats lower than heart rate max in running. And then the swimming will tend to be the lowest of the three. So that's step one, is let's kind of know what our heart rate max is or heart rate peak for these different modalities. And usually the way you can get that is through just a quite hard, say, 6-minute bout where you warm up well. You can even do an interval session and then just use one of the intervals and push it to max to get a reasonable training heart rate peak. Okay? Does that make sense?
Got it. Yep.
Yep. And then, you know, that sets at least the upper end of our aerobic scale. That's the top end of zone three is up at heart rate max. And then things get trickier. You know, if I wanted to actually find the first lactate turn point, then I kind of need to measure lactate. But as a guess, as a reasonable, educated guess, I'm going to say keep it below 75% of heart rate peak for zone one.
Yep. That makes sense.
Okay. And that'll be reasonably safe.
And that means, just to clarify, that means keep it below. So that doesn't mean start at that level and then you go higher and higher through the session, which I think is quite a common mistake when you give heart rate guidelines to athletes. So start significantly lower if you know that your heart rate tends to rise with the duration of the session.
And actually, you're touching on something that's important, is that if you really are clearly in zone one, then you should not see a big drift in the heart rate. That the heart rate you have after 15 minutes should be pretty close to the heart rate you have at 60 minutes. But if you're drifting a lot up, then there's a good chance you're actually working at a higher intensity than you think you are. You're actually at your threshold, because then we'll start to see that drift. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it brings about the question, if that happens, even when the athlete feels that they're going really, really slow, Would that also potentially show up in a lactate test if the athlete goes to a lab that they don't really have that first lactate turn point, but lactate just rises from the start? We don't have that flat plateau at the beginning.
That's what we see, is when you bring in people that don't have the good metabolic control, that have tended to do a lot of stuff at their threshold, that they're at 2.5 millimolar from the first stage in the test. You know, they just don't have the low lactate starting point. Whereas when we bring in the high, you know, the elite endurance athlete, they'll often be below 1 millimolar. And they may even go down from state, you know, from the first load to the second. Their lactate may actually decline before it eventually starts coming up again. So they have really good metabolic control. But the good news is that, you know, all is not lost, because when we take these amateurs and get them to train in a disciplined way for some weeks, it gets better. And that lactate profile starts to flatten out, starts to look more like what we see with a well-trained athlete. So it does, you know, it doesn't take years. You can achieve it in a couple of months of just good training, the right kind of training. You can see big changes where it becomes much more comfortable to do those low intensity runs and rides.
And do you think, because I get some questions from people that really, as soon as they take the first step on running, especially, I think this is the case, that their heart rate is well above where it should be for that estimated 75% of heart rate max. And yeah. What should they do if they really cannot run, or they feel they cannot run at a low enough intensity to keep heart rate down? Do you think that that's just, well, you think you cannot run, but you should be running even slower, and it is possible, it might not feel the same, but you can do it? Or should you do like run walk, or what's your take on that?
Yeah, there's no shame in walking up a hill. In fact, that was one of the first observations I made in Norway that really got me started on all of this that I've been doing for 15 years, was I watched a female athlete who I had seen in the lab. I knew she had a VO2 max of 65 mLs per kg, which is good. That's a high value for females. Her sister was an Olympic silver medalist in cross-country skiing. So I knew this woman, young woman, was a good endurance athlete, and I watched her come to the bottom of a steep hill and start walking up that hill. And I was thinking, what in the heck is going on? But what I learned was that she was doing a low intensity session that day. She was running for a couple of hours, and she just was disciplined. She didn't run up the hill. She ran fast up the hill, kept her heart rate stable. Walked fast up the hill, kept her heart rate stable, and kept going. And that was a big aha experience for me. And I think we need to remember that training is training, and don't be afraid to be disciplined. To, you know, you get to that steep hill, you walk up the hill because you have a plan that day. You're doing a 2-hour run, and you want to keep it at low intensity. Follow your plan. Let the others run by you and smile, because you know what you're doing. That's what we've seen with elite athletes as well, is that they know what they're good for, and they don't need to compete every day. They know what they're worth when it really matters. And so if some amateur runs by them when they're doing a 3-hour low intensity run, more power to them. No worries.
Check the ego at the door. That's important.
Yeah. You know, because they know that, man, if this was a race, you know, because their engine is running at half power, and that's where it needs to be that day. So that discipline up in your head of not getting half wheeled into a hard session, or running up the hills, you know, every hill you see is a hill you got to see if you can power up. Learning that, boy, it's a really tough lesson especially for us men. The women tend to be better at it. They tend to be more disciplined. But the guys like us and me, and I, believe me, I've done everything you can do wrong on that account. Learning that discipline is going to be one of the best things you'll ever do. And you will end up going faster. Slower can make you faster.
Yeah. And so moving on to the second lactate threshold, how do you estimate that if you don't have access to that lactate test?
Well, when I've talked to cyclists, what I've told them to do, and they don't all like it, I said, do an hour of power.
Oh, yes, that sounds good.
Meaning, you know, just a 60-minute test, and take your average power for the 60 minutes, and that we're going to put that and call that your zone two threshold. So that's going to be the threshold between two and three, or the marker. Like for me right now, it's 286 watts. I'm a 53-year-old guy, so I don't have much to brag about. But I know what it is because I've done the hour, and I'm trying to get it up to 300 watts, you know, for an hour. But research shows that well-trained subjects, they can hold maximum lactate steady state for an hour. So it's a reasonable surrogate measure of maximum lactate steady state. Now, it's tough. And what I can say is, if you say, oh, that hour, that is just awful, I want to just say, suck it up, you know, because you're an endurance athlete. But I can also say, well, do that once. And at the same time, within a close proximity, do a 20 or a 30 minute test and figure out what your personal calibration is. Does that make sense?
Yep, that makes absolute sense. So rather than use some arbitrary 95%, which I think for a very, very small part of athletes would be the case, but actually it's probably closer to 90% for most, but you figure out what your percentage is.
Right. So I can live with that you do the one, you know, you don't do that 60-minute very often, but that you then have it calibrated against your 20 or 30-minute test, and then you know your personal calibration. But at any rate, if we agree on that, then we'll call that FTP, and we'll say that that is your zone 2-3 demarcation. That's that second threshold. Okay?
Yeah.
So that would be my poor person's, you know, I've, in cycling, I've talked about 6-minute and 60-minute tests as reasonable proxies for maximum aerobic power and for the maximum lactate steady state, or FTP, 6-minute, 60-minute.
Yeah, that makes sense. What about heart rate in that 60-minute test, or in general heart rate for the MLSS, maximum lactate steady state? What's your take on that?
Well, as a reasonable estimate, I would say if you do an hour of power, your average heart rate for that hour will probably end up being around 90% of max. You know, it may be 88, it may be 91, but it'll be about 90. For me, when I do an hour of power, and I've done it about four times in the last 6 months or so, if I'm at 90% of heart rate max at 20 minutes in, I can hang on. That's what I found out, is that I'm paced to be able to survive at that power. Cause I have a really flat power. You know, when I start at, you know, like this last test, 286, I mean, I'm on that the whole way. So at 20 minutes, you kind of know, you feel like, is this going to be doable or is this not going to happen? You know, and if I'm at 90%, then I've got a decent chance of making it to the end. But it's going to drift up. That heart rate's going to drift up. And for me, you know, I'm by the end, I'm at 95% of heart rate peak. I'm hurting, but, you know, but that's drift. That's heart rate drift. It's not what it would be if I were fresh in a 6-minute bout. So that's my general advice would say, you can expect to have an average heart rate for that hour of about 90. You know, the first 15 minutes feel pretty good, but then you start feeling, you know, then the reality starts setting in. The first 15 minutes Yep. should feel reasonably good in an hour of power.
I've done it twice personally as well, the hour of power, but both of those times have been out on the road. I have a hard time imagining doing an hour of power on the trainer, but I'm pretty sure that that's what you do. Am I right?
It is, yeah, because I'm kind of a geek and I like to have the data. So, you know, and it's an existential kind of experience. You just I kind of like getting geared up for it, and I like having that conversation with between brain and body. That of course you triathletes have on during the race is, I think we have to get comfortable with that with that, you know. And one of the things I learned through that is just to be prepared to know, you know, usually for me, the moment of truth comes around 2/3 of the way in, you know, and the body is just starting to say, do you really need to do this? You know, this hurts. And then having an answer ready, you know, knowing, okay, I know my body's going to start revolting. It's going to start asking me to quit. And I need to have a mental strategy for how I'm going to get past that that period and then get onto the other side of it. Because usually what happens is you get over to the other side where it feels like you're kind of starting to go downhill towards the finish. So I think it's a part of the training process. I think it's good for us to deal with this in training a bit and learn some strategy, learn some tactics for how we're going to deal and what we're going to say to ourselves and so forth to get past that, you know, dark part of the hour.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that one very important takeaway here is that the 20-minute tests with the 95% coefficient, I definitely think that is a problem in cycling and triathlon training in general, because it overinflates the FTP in air quotes so massively for some people, especially those athletes that don't have that good aerobic base, so they can rely so much on anaerobic energy, not so much, but relatively speaking, compared to the more well trained athletes, that it really overinflates the threshold that you're trying to estimate to get sort of like a physiological marker of where you are.
I agree, and that's a much more problematic error. It's gonna have downstream effects on your training than if you slightly underestimate your threshold. You know, if my real threshold was 295 and I actually estimated 285, that's okay. But if I'm missing it on the, you know, if I'm overestimating by 20 watts, that's gonna end up messing things up, because I'm gonna tend to also think that I am at low intensity when I'm at threshold intensity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the downstream effects are just exactly the wrong effects. And unfortunately, guys, this just tends to be what we do, is we want those bigger numbers. Same thing happens in the weight room. If I go into a weight room with a bunch of guys and they're doing squats, I can guarantee you that they will have a tendency to cheat. They won't go down to 90 degrees, you know, but they'll get a bigger number for their squat. And so this happens in the weight room. It happens in the, you know, in threshold testing, and we've got to just, try to avoid it, because we end up making training mistakes. It's better to let your numbers do the talking on race day because you've done good training.
Yeah. And I don't know if you agree, but for cycling, something that I think it's such a power dominant sport these days with, power meters being almost ubiquitous, that heart rate has sort of been thrown out the window. And for quite some time, I also did it myself, just solely relying on power and percentages of power, the threshold, functional threshold power, etc. But I'm getting back into using heart rate more and more, and especially for those low intensity workouts, that always making sure that the heart rate is on point where it should be, so that the heart rate is low enough and that the power is low enough. I want to have that safety margin, because I know that it's not a problem if I undershoot it a little bit, but if I overshoot it, then that's a potential issue. So would you sort of do the same thing, using heart rate a lot in low intensity, or how would
I love power, and I have power on every workout I do, but I also have heart rate. And I just keep myself honest. And it turns out that for me personally, if I, you know, I tend to do these low intensity sessions, usually about 2 hours, 100 minutes to two hours is a very typical low intensity session for me on the bike inside. And I watch heart rate, and I can almost tell if I'm where I need to be and I'm well recovered just based on what that heart rate is. I look at the heart rate relative to kind of 200 watts, which is my zone one, kind of towards the upper end of zone one for me. And I can really feel, you know, or I can look at the heart rate and say, okay, I'm where I need to be, and it's flat, and I know that tomorrow when I do high intensity, I'm ready. I'm exactly where I want to be. So I love power, and don't get me wrong, it's great that we can measure it, but the physiology still matters, and we still need to have that calibration. And it's so easy to get lured into letting that power slide up. Because it's just, it feels good at first, you know, to go a little harder. But then we start drifting into that typical problem of every workout being kind of half hard. And that will, it won't get you where you want to be down the road.
Yeah, I think the alternative to that is very exciting, I think personally, is when you just keep your easy rides at sort of the same power as long as it feels easy enough. You feel that you don't know that you're not overshooting it. Mm. And then you see week by week your heart rate coming down for the same sort of power. That's exciting. And you can see that you're adapting well to the training.
And the other thing you can also do is just, as we talked about, is extend these workouts. And I find with myself, when I first started riding, again, you know, for me, an hour, that was a good low-intensity session. And then 90 minutes started to feel right. And now 2 hours feels right. But for me, still 3 hours feels pretty long. And so I would like to get where a three-hour ride on the bike feels easy, you know, where I am flat, that heart rate just stays flat for 3 hours. And so I'm slowly building durability, building this, you know, I've called it biological durability. And I think that pays dividends down the road in the racing. So that's part of the adaptation process. It's not always about doing more power. It's also about being able to do the same power, you know, and feel comfortable with it. And now that becomes easy for you. That means you've got a bigger base. You've got a stronger aerobic base to work with. And that's a great foundation for moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I don't know if it may have been you that talked about it on some podcast or wherever I heard it, maybe somebody else, but how important that power at LT1 is such a big predictor of endurance performance, especially in events like triathlons. So we're not talking about 6 minute races here. We're talking about longer races, at least 1 hour. So actually, your power at LT2 at that second at that FTP might not matter as much necessarily as that power at LT1. So what you can really comfortably do for a long, long time in a sustainable manner.
Yeah, I think if we were to look at the peloton of, you know, the pro tour, we would see that they tend to have a really high LT1. That's one of the things that distinguishes the riders in general that make it to that level. And then even within that group, you'll see that the very best have just an exceptional ability to produce, reasonably high powers without it costing them anything. If you watch the Tour of Flanders this weekend, the winner, the winning time was 6 hours and 18 minutes. And about that last hour that athlete did, they had a lot of minutes at 400, 500 watts, peaking at 900 watts. I mean, just so 5 hours of work and then the race begins, you know. And that requires an athlete with a lot of, you know, a great base to be able to put out that world-class hour after 5 hours of work. And that's the only way to get that is to do the hours over time. That's the only way we know. You can't do it with interval training. The only way to get to the third hour is to do the first two. You know, there are no shortcuts. The only way to get your body to the point where it gets comfortable in that fourth hour is to do 4 hour workouts, you know, like you're doing. There is no shortcut there.
Exactly. Just briefly about that setting the zones and for running then, or at the LT2 especially, because we talked about cycling, the 60 minute test, the hour of power, but for running, what do you recommend and for setting your zones there?
Well, I mean, in theory, it's essentially the same, because the physiology is the physiology. But in practical terms, again, I could see using a 10K. 10K is going to be a bit too fast, you know, because you're going to be probably above MLSS at the end of a 10K, but it's close, you know. I still think what you can do for an hour is a pretty good measure of your maximum lactate steady state, also for running. But I know an hour run, that's tough. So I would tend to, I would probably take 10K time and then add some amount, but I'm a little bit unsure what, if I want to say some specific value there. I have to think a little bit about that. It's been a lot of cycling.
If you have a 10K and a half marathon time, then you could basically maybe take the
middle,
whatever pace you had between between the two.
Yeah, and that's kind of where it's at, I suspect, for maximum lactate steady state. Is 10K is just a bit too fast, and in half marathon, you're probably, for most people, you're a bit on the slow side. So it's still, in terms of the physiology, is still related to the duration, and that duration is, you know, that 60 minute duration turns out to work pretty well as a surrogate measure for what you can maintain. At least 40 minutes and then up to 60 minutes is where I'd want to have as a functional test. You know, what's the speed or the power you can hold in that range? Minimum 40 minutes.
I would estimate that for a well-trained athlete, if you add 5 seconds per kilometer to your 10K pace, that would be roughly the 60-minute pace.
Yep.
And for a less well-trained athlete, perhaps you add a little bit more, like 7, 8, 9 seconds per kilometer.
And that's the thing. It's not that many seconds per kilometer. You know, the range is fairly narrow in running compared to the cycling power.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that sounds about right.
Let's talk a little bit about triathlon-specific considerations here, because one thing that, especially if we consider the 80% of sessions being low intensity and 20% of sessions being high intensity, that gets difficult, especially for the age groupers,
sure,
if you want to do some high intensity in the swim and the bike and the run, because there just aren't enough sessions in a week.
And here's my take on that. I suspect that some of your age groupers sometimes are doing more than one session in a day, the really dedicated ones. And I'd say, all right, that's okay. That's great if you can manage that. But let's think about trying to manage the loads in the days so that I would be more comfortable with an athlete doing actually two hard sessions on one day, you know, a cycling and a run session that are both hard on the same day, and then being able to have a really good low intensity or rest day after, then spreading these hard sessions so that they seem to be doing something hard almost every day. That's going to be the problem if they fall into that trap. Does that make sense? So I would rather overload a day and really have tough, hard days, and then make sure we're protecting the easy days.
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm doing personally again. But I also know that there are, for example, recently we had Joel Filial on as a guest, who's one of the greatest triathlon coaches out there for elites. And they do it differently. He spreads out the intensity, so they have some intensity most days, like 6 days of the week perhaps, and then a second and maybe a third easy session. But they don't stack the days that way. So I think that there's probably individual variability what works best, but for me, I found that what you suggest works really well with stacking intensities or doing two hard sessions on one day and then making sure that the next day can be a low intensity day. And a low intensity day might be a high volume day still, but it's still a low intensity.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's my take on it. And we got to remember that the best in the game, they are different beasts. And one of the things that makes them great endurance athletes, great triathletes, is they can absorb a hell of a lot of training. And so what they can absorb is not necessarily, you know, really representative for what the 7 hour a week athlete can handle. So that's why I think for a lot of us, that stacking approach is a more sustainable way to go. Because it gets tough. If you're doing that many days a week with those hard sessions, I wouldn't be able to handle it. I wouldn't be able to survive it. And I think a lot of age groupers would really struggle.
Yeah. And what would your perspective be on the different disciplines? Like, would you try to follow more or less this sort of polarization, or at least like, let's call it 90% of time in zone in that low intensity zone in all three different disciplines? Or would you be okay with doing a little bit more intensity in one discipline? And what's your take on that?
Well, just from a pure, you know, if we take the Olympic distance, then obviously the run is so critical. There's just no way to get around that. You need to be a strong runner if you want to be a strong Olympic distance performer. And plus, physiologically, running is going to, you know, challenge the cardiovascular system. So I would tend to maybe wait a bit more interval sessions on running. And then the other kind of depends on what your strengths and weaknesses are. If you're a terrible swimmer versus if you're a good swimmer, you know, your cycling strength and so forth. But, you know, I'm never going to do a triathlon because I suck at swimming, and I would probably be at, you know, near drowning as soon as I start swimming. So these issues play a role. Is for, you know, are you a swimmer that can actually swim at low intensity? I'm not sure. I suspect there's a lot of swimmers, at least the early days when they're doing, getting into the sport, they're probably at fairly high intensity the whole way.
Absolutely.
In swimming.
Yeah.
And so for that athlete, I'm going to say, let's just totally focus on getting comfortable in the water, not on intensity, but getting comfortable, trying to let the technique carry you more, and then, you know, and not flail with high intensity sessions in the pool, but really work on moving your body through the water more effectively, because they'll probably benefit more from that than they will from flailing at high intensity with bad technique. So I would probably front load or, you know, the running and the cycling a bit more than the swimming, and just really try to work on, good swimming mechanics, moving through the water, good breathing and so forth for most age groupers, unless they're really strong swimmers.
Let's take a concrete example here. This, I think, would be quite a common, age group listener would perhaps do 3 workouts per week in swimming, biking, and running, and that might be, let's call it 9 to 10 hours in total duration. How many intense workouts would you do in each discipline, and where would you do maybe a longer workout, if you can sort of give an ID for just your perspective on how roughly you would structure that training week?
Well, just as a starting point, if we're going to kind of basically follow that 80-20 rule on sessions, 9 sessions, I'm not going to do more than 2 or 3 hard sessions. Already 2 of 9 is actually more than 20%. But I can live with that. But, you know, 3 hard sessions out of 9 is probably enough for an age grouper. You know, and in fact, for some, it's going to be too much. I think, you know, and there's going to be a tendency for them to try to solve all problems with more intensity. But that's not going to be a good solution. So you're going to want, if I'm coaching them, I'm going to really work on, you know, helping them to be patient and to make sure that the low intensity sessions are exactly that, that we've got the heart rate on, that we're actually learning how to calibrate these sessions and getting comfortable going longer at these low intensity sessions. And then we're going to make sure that our high intensity sessions are in that correct zone where they don't go over the top. They don't go into the very highest intensity, but they keep it around the 90% that we've talked about and collect minutes. And then we can start to say, look, every week doesn't have to be the same. There's a tendency to think, well, this is the structure for the week, but you can do 3 interval sessions 1 week and only 2 the next, and that's fine. And you can front load, and maybe this week you do 2 running sessions, and another one you do 2 bike sessions. So we don't need to get too trapped in that, because one of the things we need to think about is that the training process is hundreds of sessions in the course of a year. And that's really worthwhile to have in the back of the head, that even an age grouper that's only training, let's say 6 times a week, that's 300 sessions in a year. And so
yep.
Every one of those sessions is just a tiny part of the bigger picture. And I want my athlete, the way I'm going to measure the success of that season is, if the plan was to achieve 300 sessions where 70 of them or 75 were going to be hard, were we able to achieve that? Were they able to stay healthy enough that they actually achieved those goals? That's going to be a measure of the overall success. And if they're staying healthy, if they're able to feel good about the hard sessions, you know, they're ready to do them and they have a sustainable program, then we're going to see long-term progress.
That's a really good point of really stretching out the perspective that you're looking at your training and not being too focused on the week. We tend to be all consumed with the training week, but it's actually so much bigger than just the week. So I like that perspective and that advice.
So our cross country skiers, for example, they have some of these rules of thumb that they need to achieve in terms of total hours a year, and they'll tend to say, look, we're going to need to do if we're going to have a successful year, we need to get about 100 hard sessions in per year. Now they're doing a total of 500 sessions. 550, but they know that as a rule of thumb, they're going to need to have 100 hard sessions a year to have the kind of fitness they need to be competitive. So that's their big picture. You know, they're aware of that big picture, and that gives you a little bit, you can relax a little bit if you get sick for 3 days, because you can say, well, don't forget, this is a long season, 500 sessions, 3 days is not going to kill me. 3 days in bed or 3 days off. So when we have that bigger perspective, I think it really does help to keep that in mind. And unfortunately, we have a tendency to think that every little detail, how we micromanage these interval sessions and so forth is going to be so critical. But I'm afraid to say, I don't think the body is that sensitive to all of our neuroses as athletes, so keep it simple. Keep it simple. It turns out to be a great lesson. And let's keep in mind, some of the best athletes in the world, let's take Kenyan runners. Not all of them even own a heart rate monitor, and they're running world-class times. So you don't have to overthink things.
Yeah, that is a good example, an excellent example. Only a couple of questions more. I know we're running a bit short on time already, but one thing that I want to ask is if you have to play devil's advocate against all of these things, polarized training in general, and like, for example, have you seen examples of athletes that do really well with doing a lot of mid-zone work, like that kind of zone 2 work, doing a lot of that or anything else? Is there any evidence out there for athletes doing well with a much higher intensity load overall than what you have prescribed here?
you know, I got to be, obviously I'm biased because I've been doing this a long time, but I really haven't. And like one of the, I was at a dinner one time with a Norwegian coach who had coached 12 world champions in 4 different sports. So he had a pretty good, you know, basis for saying things. And he says, there is one certainty with endurance training. If you want to be great, you got to train a lot. You know, that was for him. It was just, you know, that he says, but you also have to train smart. And so that's, I haven't seen these shortcut moments. I'm not saying that no one's ever achieved it. And I will say this, what I have seen is athletes that have a long background of doing the volume, and then maybe they're coming to the end of their career, or they have a year where they say, I'm going to try to cut my hours from 1,000 down to 800 or 700, and they can still have some success. You know, they've got the base, they know how their body works, and they can get away with a season at a lower volume than they, but because they've done it before, they know how to get there. But even those, what we tend to see in it at the world class level is they're less consistent. They start having to cherry pick when they can be good, whereas a top class World Cup athlete that's able to produce over the course of a World Cup season, what they will generally say is I had a great preparation period. I got the volume in, and that's what is keeping me going through this season. So that's what we've seen. There's always going to be the exception. I'm sure we'll see it somewhere, but I wouldn't want to base my coaching on that.
I have a hypothesis that I'd be curious to hear your take on, and that is that for a certain amount of time, and I don't know how long, but I think it's very individual, like depending on your training background and your genetics and so on, athletes can see good improvements when they train with much more intensity, whether it's mid-zone intensity or high-zone intensity, but at some point they will stagnate. We talked about stagnation before, as you say. I just think that the time course is what varies a lot with athletes, and then to get through that stagnation, then that's when you need to really build that stronger base and that biological durability that you also mentioned. So what do you think about that?
I agree. And actually, there's a wonderful case study on a Norwegian athlete. She ended up being the most winning cross country skier in the history of the sport on the women's side. And she was a talented athlete that won a world championship already in 2005. And her coach was very in favor of a lot of high intensity training and did some high intensity blocks where, you know, multiple days in a row with high intensity. And she responded to it. She won a world championship with this. You know, she was still doing a lot of low intensity, but she was doing more high intensity than was normal in Norway, quite a bit more. And she wins. But then she really was not able to keep making progress. She started to stagnate. And so world champion in 2005, and she's considering quitting the sport by 2008-09.
Wow.
Because her results have failed, and she's no longer on the podium very often at all. Towards the end, 2009, she was basically off the podium completely. So she had stagnated with this approach, and she ended up having to go back to basics, cut out this block high intensity work, go back to that traditional model with a lot more low intensity, relatively less high intensity, and she brought it back. And then she had a 5-year period where she was essentially unbeatable. You know, so it was sustainable, and for 5 years she just dominated the sport. So she achieved success with a kind of a high intensity loaded approach, but she wasn't able to sustain it, and she ended up stagnating. Then she went back to this more traditional model of that we've been talking about, and had a sustained period of success all the way to retirement, or to actually the birth of a child and then retirement. And this is all documented as a case study that's published in, I believe it's in Frontiers of Physiology. So it's free. It's you can find it yourself, and it's a great little insight into the career of an athlete.
Yeah, we can link to that in the show notes. So yeah, that will be good for the listeners interested. So let's start to wrap it up here. There's a whole list of questions that you also have in front of you that we haven't covered yet, but I think that we've covered the most important things for now, and that perhaps we can revisit the topic later on with some more discussions. But to wrap up this discussion, let's just go through the rapid fire questions that I ask every guest. And the first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to endurance sports?
Oh, well, my all-time favorite is The Textbook of Work Physiology by Ostrand and Rodahl, which is published way back in the 70s, different editions. But that was my inspiration, and some of the key questions and the way they approach the physiology is still has inspired a lot of the work I've done up to today. So I guess that's the all-time favorite. As far as any specific source today, I'm kind of all consuming, I try not to get trapped into one specific book or anything like that. I just try to stay on top of things and perhaps nowadays I'm a bit more on the psychology side. The physiology, I feel like, you know, I've got a reasonable grip on the physiology. So I've enjoyed, like, I've read a bit from Steve Magnus recently on the passion paradox. So some of these issues about the psychological side of the training process is interesting to me, because you know, ultimately you have to combine the two.
Yeah. What's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
Oh, when I get my head wrapped around something, I don't let go too easily. So I guess that's an advantage. You know, it helps. And I'm passionate about this stuff. I love it. So that helps. But I think you need some endurance also in your work process, you know, because it takes time to get good answers.
Yeah. And finally, what do you wish you had known or done differently at some point in your career?
In my career as a scientist,
it could be as a professional, or it could be endurance sports.
Open
for interpretation.
Yeah, in endurance sports, I did everything that I'm telling the listeners not to do. I did it, so I wish somebody had told me what I'm telling them right now, because I just killed myself with interval training, and I stagnated. I kicked my own butt. For sure. So I wish somebody had sat me down and taught me this whole concept of you know, the longer low intensity sessions. I would have had a better career for sure.
Yeah, and I've also done that at some different periods of my career. So definitely that makes two of us that can say that. Yeah, there is definitely a limit for how much of that you can do, and the low intensity stuff is what is really sustainable and building that. I wish we could have discussed biological durability a lot more, because I'm very interested in that and find it super important, but we'll save that for another time. But just to summarize, I guess that building that up with low intensity training, that's something that we can agree is super, super important and should be one of the key take-home messages, I think, for the listeners from this episode.
Yeah, I tell you, I'm 50 some odd years now, old 53, and I am handling interval sessions better today than I did when I was 25. And I think it's just because I'm not chronically fatigued. So there is hope out for us. That's what I can say. You know.
Yeah, and your
286. It's still hard, but we've got to learn when to do it and when to hold back.
Yeah, exactly. And your 286 watt hour of power, and not 95% of 20-minute FTP. That also proves that what you're doing is working in practice, because that's quite impressive.
It's getting better. I've only been cycling for about 8 months, but I'm going to get to 300. That's my goal.
I'm sure you will. Okay. Right. Thank you so much, Stephen. It was a real pleasure to have you on the podcast.
The same. Thank you.
So I really hope that you enjoyed that discussion. Since Stephen has been such a requested guest, I hope that it was worth the wait. I certainly think that it was. I have plenty of takeaways, but I'm going to limit it to a few of them. I do want to give a few because I think it's important to sort of wrap things up here with what the things to think about and consider with your training are. And the first is really easy. It's doing a lot of easy training volume. That's perhaps the most important thing that you can be doing as an endurance athlete. But also remember here with this that just because you think you're doing it easy enough, it doesn't mean that you actually are necessarily. So I definitely recommend that you try to go and get a lactate test done. But if you cannot do that, go back and listen to where we defined how to set your zones and get some estimates for where you should be training in terms of heart rate and power if you haven't done so. And then you can check and validate that your easy training is actually easy enough. The second takeaway is to take that big picture view of your training rather than just the weekly microcycle view. So if you're a typical age group athlete, it might feel that, well, I mean, I can only train so many hours per week, so many workouts per week. How is it possible that I can get faster if I do 80% of my workouts at low intensity, which I sort of agree with as a triathlete, especially, it is difficult. And I don't do 80% of my workouts at an easy intensity, I have to say. So perhaps for triathlete, it makes a bit more sense to follow that those time-based recommendations, time in zone-based recommendations. Either way, it can feel that, well, if I'm only allowed to do 10% of my workout duration, total workout duration at a high intensity, then how am I supposed to improve when I can only train 8 hours per week? It helps if you look at the yearly hours that you train rather than the weekly hours. So you might be doing 300 to 400 workouts per year if you're a typical triathlete, maybe 400 to 500 hours of training. And then suddenly this idea of polarized training, it starts to seem a lot more conceivable, I think, when compared to struggling to believe that you can improve when you're looking at it from the weekly microcycle basis, which makes sense, right? Because you're not going to improve in just a week if you do a few easy workouts. That's not going to happen. But when you stack them one week after another, and you keep doing that for a year or for many years, that's when the magic happens. That's when it really happens. And that's, I think, when this idea, this concept becomes really, really valuable, when you can take a step back and take that big picture view rather than just look at your next 12-week build to your next race or your next couple of months that you're training for whatever event that you're preparing for. Next, I think it's very important to assess different views, opposing views, of whatever the point of discussion is. So it was good to get Stephen's view on him playing devil's advocate there on whether there is contradicting evidence. And what Stephen said there is that in terms of research, nothing that he's aware of. We talked about how anecdotally, sure, there are always exceptions, and also you can potentially have quite a lot of success on more intensity, but perhaps it's more of a short to mid-term solution and not necessarily working as well in the long term. And that's why the large majority of all the best athletes seem to be following these sorts of principles that we've been talking about, because to be the best of the best, it requires successful training over the long term and not just over the short term. So I think it was important to get that question and getting Stephen to play devil's advocate there, because it does come up a lot. And I'll actually try to talk a little bit more about that specific question and topic in the next episode. So stay tuned for that. Final takeaway, this model does fit in very, very well with what the best coaches and the triathlon coaches here in the world are doing, and I want to point you to some of the most popular and best episodes that I've had on the podcast, in my opinion, the best and most useful ones, and download numbers seem to support that. I'm thinking specifically of interviews with Joel Filial and Arild Tveiten. Those were episodes 172 for Joel Filial and 154 for Arild Tveiten. And you can listen to those, re-listen to those, and the principles are exactly the same. A lot of training, a lot of easy training, building that aerobic engine. And the important thing isn't what you call it, so Joel wouldn't call what they're doing polarized training, and Arild probably wouldn't call it polarized either. Maybe it's pyramidal, maybe it's just endurance training. It's all just semantics at the end of the day, but what they're doing fits very nicely with what these concepts that and principles that we talked about here, what they are. So those are recommended episodes to listen to again and see how they fit in with this view. So that's about it for the takeaways. As usual, you can find the show notes for this episode on thattriathlonshow.com, and I'll link to the related episodes, including Arild Tveiten, Joel Filial, also my episode that I did on Seiler's hierarchy of endurance training needs back in episode 120. I did a review of that presentation that Stephen held, which has become very famous and is a really good one. So go and check that out, episode 120. And I'll also link to plenty of the best research papers that Stephen and his colleagues have done, including several of the ones that we talked about mentioned specifically, like the case study with the cross-country skier and plenty of other ones, the recovery from zone 1 versus zone 2 versus zone 3, etc. So as I alluded to, actually, in the next episode, I will keep talking about polarized training, but it will be a solo episode because there were so many questions that we could barely scratch the surface today. So next week, I'll come back and try to answer a lot of these questions myself. And I'll also talk a bit more about my own perspectives on polarized training and maybe even my own training and how it fits in with this model. If you're new to the podcast, please make sure that you subscribe so that you get that episode and all the other ones when they are released and don't miss any of the goodies that we have coming out here. There will be plenty of really great episodes coming out in the coming weeks. I can assure you that. And if you're a long-time listener and you haven't yet rated and reviewed the podcast, please, please, please go and do that. It really helps a lot. I want to thank everyone who has rated and reviewed the podcast. It is making a difference. I'm noticing it because there are slightly more reviews coming in, and then the download numbers are growing, which is essential for the sustainability of this podcast. So please, please help out with those ratings and reviews. It is massively appreciated and needed. And of course, spread the word. Just talk to your triathlon buddies, your family members, anybody who might be interested in listening to the podcast. Tell them to subscribe and start listening. Start binging on the content that we have in the archives, because there are plenty of episodes by now to sink your teeth into. Big thanks to our sponsors, Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Get 20% off your entire order with the promo code TTS, all caps. And thank you to Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. You can get your first box of Precision Hydration electrolytes for free with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW, all one word, all caps. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.